Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour, we're going to pick up where we left off with that CBS 60 Minutes piece, Ed Bradley, dealing with the issue of embryonic stem cell research. Big promises made before the break that embryonic stem cell research is that leap forward that only happens every century, according to the researcher they're talking to, and that it will deal with every human disease. I don't think he misspoke. I think he meant to say every human disease. That's a lot of diseases. I mean, I can think of a lot of diseases, and new ones are coming online every day. Is that the real promise of embryonic stem cell research? I want your response to this. We'll be stopping and starting it occasionally throughout the hour. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In the third hour of the program, we'll talk about vegetative states. Terry Schindler-Scheibe was said to have been in the persistent vegetative state. That became a household term with us. What does it really mean? And how is that distinguished from what people call brain death? How is that distinguished from what someone who is simply unconscious or in a coma? And is it any reason to withdraw from a person in a persistent vegetative state what they withdrew from Terry Schindler-Scheibe, her food and her water until she died? We'll talk about that in the second hour. The last half hour will conclude our six-part series on orthodoxy, and we'll be talking with Pastor Gene Smith, who spent 5 years as a deacon and 10 as a priest in the old calendar jurisdiction of the Greek Orthodox Church. We'll be talking about orthodoxy and icons. If you don't know what an icon is, it's you've seen it. It's a picture, usually the very formalized, formulaic pictures of Jesus or a saint or Mary and the child. But they're more than pictures in orthodoxy. How much more than pictures, we'll find out in the last half hour. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. Anything you want to talk about, but let's go back to Ed Bradley and his conversation with this researcher and embryonic stem cell research.
That's because embryonic stem cells, these little white dots, which are extracted from embryos just 5 days after fertilization, are capable of becoming any type of cell in the body, can be grown in infinite numbers, and can replace cells that have been destroyed or damaged by disease or injury.
And for humans, how many would you put into humans?
We'll have to put roughly 20 million cells into a human.
That's a lot of cells.
That's the beauty of this cell type. You can make a lot of cells.
Suzanne Short has been closely watching Hans Kierstedt's work every step of the way. She was paralyzed from the neck down 24 years ago when a drunk driver crashed into her car. She meets regularly with Dr. Kierstedt and hopes one day to be treated with his stem cells.
If you found out one day that you could be eligible for a clinical trial, what would you say?
Yeah, I'd jump at the chance. I used to say I didn't want to be first, but I'd be second. I think at my age now, I'd be willing to go first.
And what do you hope that eventually it might be able to do for you?
Whether I walk or not, I really don't care. And you know, if I do, that's great. But I mean, if I could just wake up one morning and not have to wait for someone to come in my room and get me out of bed, I could at least transfer myself into my own wheelchair. It'd be amazing. You know, I'd be completely independent.
Suzanne Short, a professional artist, is confident that it's not a question of if that will happen, but when. That's because of what Dr. Kierstedt has been able to accomplish with embryonic stem cells in just the past 5 years. He transformed them into a specific type of nervous system cell that is needed for the spinal cord to function properly. He showed us an animation of what happened after he injected more than a million of those cells directly into the spinal cords of rats that were partially paralyzed.
All right, there was the animation. Now, of course, on the radio, can't see the animation. Very realistic animation of a rat walking. Now, the videotape before had been a real rat dragging itself along by its front legs, and then the animation of what happened. Now, did they not videotape the rats? I don't know. I don't doubt that this actually occurred. But why show an animation rather than, well, here's the videotape. We thought it was important to videotape the paralyzed rat, but then when we got to the walking rat, we thought, what the heck, let's just have someone work up a computer animation for us. No, show us the videotape. This is television. I want to actually see it happen. They never explain why it was an animation and not an actual tape. Did they say an injection of more than 1 million cells? Yes. In fact, he said it has to be 200 million cells into a human being to get the same kind of effect. And, of course, the response was, well, we can make as many of these cells as we want to. Now, the debate here is not whether or not researchers can do this. They can do it. What the researchers want is your money to do it. They want taxpayer money to do it because they can't get private money to do it, or they can't get very much private money. And the problem is, in order to do what they want to do, they have to clone a human embryo and then kill it and then harvest the cells. Then comes everything they're talking about in this report, which is multiplying the cells and doing the injection. They're showing you the happy side of embryonic stem cell research. They're not showing you what they have to do to get these embryonic stem cells. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. John calls from his car. John, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, first thing, I would like to try and establish one thing, what I believe in my mind, that abortion, cloning, and all this about. I just believe this is a modern-day form of sacrificing like it was in the old days to the devil himself. You know how they used to Bible record how they were throwing babies and things in the fire and all these various things.
All right.
Now, that's just my point of view about it. That's the way I see abortion and all these kinds of things. But now, maybe the doctors and things is going about the cure for various diseases the wrong way. I'm firmly convinced that there will come a time that diseases will be cured. Whether they doing it the right way now, I'm kind of against the way they doing it. But if you look at the lifespan in America, how it have grown. I mean, there was a time when everybody was against any kind of medicine or whatever. Doctors was kind of outcast and everything else. But yet, it's still medicine have saved a lot of life.
No doubt about it, John. Thank you for the call. No doubt about it. I mean, modern medicine has done wonders, and the research that's come from it has done wonders to make our lives much better. I mean, 400 years ago, I would not just be middle-aged. I would be in the twilight years of my life. Go back another 1,000 years. I would probably be dead by this point. Either from disease, I might not have even lived to be an adult. Disease, more likely war. War was pretty bloody business, so you didn't have a prospect of returning alive. So it's true, yes, with the advances of modern medicine, our lifespans have greatly increased. As to whether or not medicine will solve every problem of disease and illness, I have my doubts. I just think our knowledge, the diseases always seem to outpace us. No matter how smart and how proficient we get at dealing with them. And there'll always be things like the common cold, you know, for which we do not have a cure and perhaps never will. But I do agree with you, John, when you talk about abortion and being akin to sacrifice. Yes. While I don't think the abortionist or the woman having an abortion considers himself taking part in a sacrifice, at least in two ways you can think of it in those terms. One, what are we willing to sacrifice to have a life that is more convenient or productive or less expensive? The unborn. And at least on the part of the abortionists, I am convinced there is a bloodlust there. No doubt about it. Matt calls from Palm Bay, Florida. Matt, welcome.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Hi, Matt.
This is a depressing topic. Not that it doesn't need to be talked about, though, because, well, for me it's depressing. Because I keep thinking about all through history, all the different times that we've subjugated a certain class of people for the quote-unquote common good. It doesn't matter whether it was the Hebrews who were enslaved or if we moved to modern times, the blacks that we enslaved, the Chinese that were put to work on the railroads, in the early part of the railroads. Now we have a subclass of people or a class of people who will have no voice to stand up and say, no, I would like to live. And especially when someone creates life and then, like you said, kills it so that they can harvest these, and I love that word that they use, harvest, these cells. It just, it really gets to me.
Yeah, Matt, to me as well. Thank you for the call. It is depressing. I mean, that does seem to be a common thread in human history, the subjugation of one class of people, one group of people, to the interests of others. And Matt named just a few instances. No doubt about it in this case. We are embarking upon, those who push for embryonic stem cell research, embarking upon that threshold where it will be, in some cases, written in law, written into the constitutions of the various states of our country, that the embryo is expendable. The only kind of human cloning that will be allowed, think about this initiative that's being pushed in Missouri, the only kind of, it says it's going to ban all human cloning, but it won't. It's going to permit human cloning only for the purpose of research. What was it that Dr. Hurlbut said on our Sunday night program a couple weeks ago? He said the President's Bioethics Council had coined this term for what had been called therapeutic cloning. That's really at the heart of this whole embryonic stem cell research debate. Cloning for biomedical research. That's the term they chose. You know, they said, what do we call it? Do we call it therapeutic cloning? No, that's a euphemism. That doesn't accurately describe what this is. And so someone there on the President's Bioethics Council, some smart guy, said, look, let's just call it what it is, cloning for biomedical research. We're producing clones in order to do research with them. And Matt, I share your concerns. It's a threshold. There's a threshold crossed when sometimes by default, you mentioned slavery in our country, when we decided early on that we weren't going to address the issue of slavery. I mean, that happened at the founding of our country. There was a conscious decision made not to address the scourge of slavery. Many of the founders were opposed to it, but they decided for the sake of kind of getting things done and getting things underway, not to address the issue of slavery. We'll take that one up later. Well, how much later did it come up? And at what cost? Bloodiest war in our history. So a threshold was crossed at the very founding of our country not to deal with that issue and to allow what had this de facto threshold, this de facto idea that the African-American would be a class of people, for one reason or another, subjugated in the interests of other people. Expendable, essentially, in order to serve the interests of the rest of the population. And that's exactly what's being said here. Another one of those threshold moments, 1973, Roe v. Wade. The unborn. And it wasn't done by saying, let's kill all the unborn. No, they didn't do that. They just said, we refuse to even answer the question of when life begins. And having conveniently set aside that crucial question of when you're dealing with a human being, the Supreme Court was free then to decide that abortion ought to be legal all the way through 9 months of pregnancy. What did they do? They crossed a threshold. They conveniently set aside the question they should have answered. They didn't answer it. And it's still a question that many Americans believe is unanswered and unanswerable. We talked about this yesterday with Jennifer Lawl. A caller said, do you think that we'd even be talking about embryonic stem cell research if Roe v. Wade had not become law of the land 33 years ago? Her response, if I remember correctly, was something to the effect of, it's hard not to see a connection between the two. If the unborn in the womb is expendable to my interests, the mother's interests, then how big of a leap is it to the unborn in the test tube or the petri dish being expendable to the interests of science or medical research or, in Missouri, life-saving cures? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's more of the 60 Minutes piece.
This is a video of an injured rat. The signals going from the brain down the spinal cord, controlling all the muscles of the body, are interrupted by a spinal cord injury.
So the brain can't send the signal down.
That's right.
The new cells he created traveled right to the damaged area of the spinal cord and wrapped themselves around the nerves there, enabling the signals to flow uninterrupted through the body. 6 weeks later, the once paralyzed animals were able to lift their tails, and they could walk.
What was the reaction here in the lab when everybody saw that?
We've been riding quite high for quite a long time now. It's tremendous in research to have something working so well.
And in humans, what would be success?
I think we could call this a dazzling success if we saw the smallest improvement in the ability of a human to do anything that they could not do. If they could move a single finger, I would call that a raving success. Let's hope it's a lot more.
And are you at all concerned about giving people false hope?
Yes, absolutely. The fears of giving somebody false hope are real. We're not trying to come up with something to take you from zero capabilities to 100%. These are incremental advances, and it is experimental.
The clinical trial that Hans Kierstad hopes will take place next year would be in collaboration with Geron, the leading biotechnology company in the field. The trial would be only for people with newly injured spinal cords because Dr. Kierstad's research shows they would be more likely to benefit. He is also working to apply that research to people with long-term paralysis, like Suzanne Shore. While Dr. Kierstad has been widely praised for his work, he has also been criticized by some scientists for trying to rush his treatment into people.
Did you see that criticism that came from some people in the scientific community who said that Hans is moving too fast?
I don't think he's moving fast enough. I wish there were 10 more of him to keep working. It'll happen someday. Hopefully I'll be around for it to happen.
Since you're not sure what will happen to people when you put these cells into them, how much concern do you have about what could happen?
Tough question. I'm very concerned, and I'll be losing sleep, no doubt, when this first gets into humans. There's the potential for harm. This is a risky endeavor like any clinical trial.
What's not known is whether embryonic stem cells will integrate and function in the human body as well as they have in animals.
Now, that's a huge question that the doctor says, well, okay, there's a potential for harm. And he said he's going to be losing sleep when he actually starts doing this in human beings. You know what has happened in some cases? When they've tried to use embryonic stem cells in human beings. And I'm thinking in particular Parkinson's. People who are at late stage Parkinson's, where this is last ditch effort to do something. And they've used embryonic stem cells. In some, not every case, brain tumors. Why? Well, the promise is also the problem with embryonic stem cells. They're what they call pluripotent. They can become, at least as far as we know nowadays, they have the potential to become anything. Any cell. A brain cell? Yeah. They can become a brain cell, given the right circumstances. They can become a heart cell. A little bit later, they're going to show on CBS, they're going to show a magnification of a heart cell. A stem cell become a heart cell. Sitting there, two little cells next to each other in the Petri dish, beating like a heart, just the way heart cells do. Each individual cell rhythmically beats like your heart, all by themselves. Amazing. But when you can become anything, you can become anything. They have the potential also to become cancer and grow out of control. Now, that's not because there's some sort of sinister motive in these embryonic stem cells. It might just be a problem doctors have to overcome, or it might be a problem they can't overcome. I mean, how many patients does this doctor want to give tumors to in an effort to find a way to cure Parkinson's or help people walk again? Even if, and I should point out at this, there are risks here, and I just think they're glossing over the risks. But even if it were completely without risk, it would still be unethical. Even if this worked like a dream, here, one stem cell, take it in the morning and tomorrow you walk, it would still be unethical. Now, I'm listening carefully because I think in this entire CBS piece from 60 Minutes, they don't get to the subject of adult stem cells until they get to the opposition to embryonic stem cell research. You know, they could be talking to researchers who've been working with adult stem cells, and they could be telling success stories.
What's not known is whether embryonic stem cells will integrate and function in the human body as well as they have in animals, nor is it known what the side effects will be. Some research indicates that stem cells can form tumors or other abnormal cells. Still, most scientists have confidence in the enormous potential of stem cells to treat incurable diseases such as diabetes, Alzheimer's, and especially heart disease, which is the number one cause of death in the United States. That's a trend Dr. Robert Robbins, chair of cardiothoracic surgery at Stanford University, is working to reverse. The reason for his optimism is in this petri dish.
These are the cells that go to make up the heart muscle cells. They all started out as cells from embryos with the potential to develop into any type cell.
I mean, this looks like, if you were to look at a heart, I mean, it's beating like a heart.
Exactly. And that's the whole point.
So what you would hope to be able to do one day would be to inject these cells into someone whose heart has suffered some kind of damage.
That's right.
And to have these cells replace the damaged part of the heart.
Right.
Dr. Robbins and his team injected cells like those directly into the hearts of mice with severe cardiac disease. The researchers then tracked the cells, they're the colored areas, and determined that they had stayed in the heart and that the cells were all beating in unison. After 6 weeks, the new heart cells had replaced the damaged ones, and heart function was restored to near normal.
All right, we'll pick it up on the other side of this break. Let's get to your phone calls here as we go to this break. Paul calls from his car. Paul, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Hi, Todd. A couple things real quick. I just wanted to I always wonder on what argument physicians and scientists in the medical field think that they can divorce their work from the Hippocratic Oath and from normative medical ethics and push what is clearly a purely utilitarian agenda. And also, I saw this piece myself, and I was really bothered by the lack of candor on the part of this scientist who, this classical reference that we hear of the existing embryonic stem cell lines and simply want to use them because they're going to be this, as if that was the be-all and end-all of the research at hand.
Thank you very much, Paul. Good points. The first one especially, you raised the utilitarian ethic. I mean, that's a kind of a technical term, but what it means is the utilitarian ethic is we decide what is right and wrong based upon the greater good. Does that sound kind of harmless? It isn't. We don't decide what's right and wrong based on the greater good. We'll respond to that on the other side of this break and take more of your phone calls. Stay tuned.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Pastor Chad Bird, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why you should consider scheduling a visit to their campus today.
The church is always in need of pastors to preach the gospel and to administer the sacraments. And so we love to have any men who are interested visit our campus, learn what goes on here, sit in on classes, get a feel for what it's like to attend the seminary. And to consider the ministry as a calling in order that God might be served in the preaching of his word and the giving of his gifts.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call them toll-free 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the Concordia Theological Seminary logo.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Not all the money being thrown at public education is paying off. New numbers from the American Legislative Exchange Council paint a dismal picture of education in the U.S. Since 1984, educational spending has steadily increased, but student performance has not. Kim Troby reports.
Of the 10 states that increased per pupil spending the most, only two rank in the top 10 in achievement. State by state, the public education system is receiving a failing grade. Lori Drummer is with the American Legislative Exchange Council.
We've increased education spending in the past 20 years by over 54% in real dollars, and we've not seen any correlation of improved student achievement. These students are going into our university system having to go through tons of remedial and mediary classes their first year, and that eats up at their time in college.
Okay, how about this? Artificial brain cells or electronic memory enhancement that will improve your test scores. I need that now.
Sydney Chipchase sees the result of that assessment. She's a workshop presenter for DeVry University and says many kids are academically unable to get into college.
There's programs set up now to get them so they can pass the entrance exam.
Liam Julian, a researcher with the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, recommends standards, accountability, and school choice to fix the problem.
Pouring money into schools is not the way to solve the educational problems that we have in the country.
You can find out how your state fares at alec.org. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
73% of public school eighth graders taking the test performed below the proficiency level in math, and 70% of them scored below proficiency in reading. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Next time on Focus on the Family, former Army officer Don Koppel tells how God softened his crusty heart. It's a humorous, insightful look at the power of prayer and the faithfulness of God. A program that entertains while it encourages. Coming up on the next edition of Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Are the visions and oracles found in the Old Testament book of Ezekiel relevant to God's people today? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can get more information about this commentary on our website, issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, our February book of the month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're hearing some CBS 60 Minutes audio. Ed Bradley doing an interview and a piece on embryonic stem cell researcher with what he's calling this scientist who is making the greatest breakthroughs in embryonic stem cell research. One thing that is so far not been mentioned in this CBS piece, it's conspicuously absent. Maybe it will get mentioned in the course of the package. It wasn't just weeks ago, maybe a month ago, that this South Korean researcher claimed to have found all sorts of new lines of stem cells in South Korea using human cloning. His research gets published in a prestigious peer-reviewed scientific journal, international scientific journal, and then it's discovered that his research is bogus and unethical. Not just unethical from my perspective, but unethical from the peer-reviewed journal's perspective. And everybody has egg on their face. I mean, the promises may be there. Anyone can make a promise. Anyone can promise, if you give me enough money, I got this thing in my garage, give me enough money, and I can turn water into gasoline. I can promise that. Now, if you hear repeated explosions coming from my garage on a nightly basis, you might wonder whether or not my research is harmful. If you see me driving down the street with a water-powered car, well, there's some proof. The problem is to get to the proof that the embryonic stem cell researchers want to show us, they have to cross a Grand Canyon of ethical concerns. not the least of which is who must die so that their research can go on. Even if the promises are true, even if they know for sure that they can make the lame walk and the blind see and all these kind of things, that Grand Canyon of ethical concerns still exists. Now, one response to Paul's call before the break, he talked about this utilitarian morality, this utilitarian ethic, basically that the greater good determines what is right and wrong. This ethic is very common. Most people in the world today have no real problem with this. How do we determine what is right to do in any situation, what is wrong to do in any situation? Well, we measure it by which serves the greater good. The end justifies the means. That's the utilitarian ethic in a nutshell. If the end is the greater good, then whatever means we need to go through to get to that end is also good. It's a rejection of moral absolutes, that there is any objective standard of right and wrong regardless of the ends. It also, it kind of nonsensically rejects the idea that human beings can do the right thing for the wrong reason or the wrong thing for the right reason. If I can prove that it serves the greater good, then I can assert that it is good. It's entirely subjective. Just ask the question, who determines what the greater good is? Government? You? Your neighbor? Your neighbor's greater good might not be your greater good. Can I make the case that annexing my neighbor's property serves the greater good? I might be able to. If I were a clever lawyer, I might be able to make a real case that annexing my neighbor, next door neighbor's property, his backyard, for instance, and making it mine, serves the greater good. I might be able to make the case that my neighbor isn't using his backyard to the greater good. He's just using it for himself. He's got a swimming pool, and he's got a nice deck back there. And I might say, he's only using it for his good. It needs to be used for the greater good. I'm going to knock down his fence so the whole neighborhood can enjoy his swimming pool. Now, I know that that seems wrong, but the end is the greater good, don't you understand? My neighbor might have a problem with this. Everyone, every criminal sitting in prison thinks that he was acting according to the greater good. Every guy who goes in to rob a liquor store thinks he's acting according to the greater good. That the end, you ask him, is what you're doing right? Well, I don't know if it's right, but it's right for me. Right now, this is the thing I have to do. The end justifies the means. Those are extreme examples, but that's the utilitarian ethic. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Back to 60 Minutes.
So looking at the big picture, what's the significance of your findings?
Well, I think that there's a lot of enthusiasm for this area of research. There's great hope for patients that suffer from heart failure that may be too old or can't get a heart transplant. And a heart transplant is a big operation. You would much prefer having a therapy that you could go out of the hospital with just a Band-Aid on your leg versus having a big operation to replace your whole heart.
I imagine you must hear from a lot of people who've had heart attacks. Who want to know if you'll be able to treat them with embryonic stem cells.
Right.
What do you tell them?
Well, I would say that it's at least 5 to 10 years away before I think that we will have enough definitive data in animal studies that it will be safe to go forward with embryonic stem cells.
Scientists say the pace of research has been slowed down by President Bush's ban in 2001 on the use of federal funds to create new lines of embryonic stem cells. Researchers need those new stem cells to expand their work because the existing lines are at least 5 years old and may have been weakened over time, limiting their value. However, extracting new stem cells destroys human embryos, which the president strongly opposes.
How do you deal with people who feel that what you're doing is morally, ethically wrong? Because in a sense, you're destroying life to save life.
I don't feel what I'm doing is morally wrong. I think the use of human embryonic stem cells is an ethical and responsible thing to do with tissue that would have been destroyed in the discards of a fertility clinic.
But there are people who would say that that is life.
So let's use it instead of discarding it. Why discard it? If you think that is a holy thing, then value it, treasure it, and keep it Use it for research and the betterment of lives. Don't throw it away.
In an effort to create a safe haven for embryonic stem cell research, in 2004, California voters passed Proposition 71, allocating $3 billion in state money to fund development of new stem cell lines. While that enticed some of the top researchers in the field to move to California, the funds have not yet been released because of lawsuits challenging Proposition 71.
Now, we talked about those lawsuits yesterday with Jennifer Law. It's not exactly a challenge to Prop 71. What it is, it's a challenge to whether or not the agency set up to hand out the dough to the researchers is constitutional. It's the fox guarding the hen house scenario that's being alleged by those who are bringing the suit in California, which is we have people set up on these boards to hand out $3 billion plus to researchers who have a vested interest in the research. They're not dispassionate in the way they're going to hand out this money. And the way Jennifer Law put it yesterday was the lawsuit alleges that basically we're handing these universities and research facilities a blank check and just saying don't spend more than $3 billion. Dennis calls from his car, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Thanks for waiting, Dennis.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, Pastor Todd, for taking my call. And I'd like to share something with you. I had a conversation yesterday about stem cell and stem cell research yesterday with an Episcopalian and a Hindu. And, part of the argument that the Episcopalian gave was that this was just a clump of cells and that it didn't have any life. So I pressed her further on that. I said, well, then what is your concept of God? Is God close to us, or do you believe in a personal God? And he said, no, God is out there. You know, God is not close. So, I don't believe in a personal God.
This was the Episcopalian?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Sound like the Hindu for a minute.
Well, then the Hindu chided. She said, no. She said, this is life. She said, those cells are sacred, and all life is sacred. I thought, well, that was interesting, from the perspective is that, the Hindu believes in pantheism and that everything has God in it. So, the table had God in it. The chairs have God in it. God is a part of everything.
Right.
But the Christian, this Episcopalian, when I pressed her on, she had children. I said, well, this clump of cells potentially could be one of your children and would grow into it. So is it okay to use them for research and destroy them? She said, well, no, that's wrong. I said, well, how on one point could a clump of cells be wrong if it's potentially a human being? I said, so at what point is it not a human being? At what point? And that's the argument.
Yes.
That one has to use. At what point is it not a human being? Is it not a human being 6 or 7 days outside of the womb because it's not self-aware? I mean, self-awareness is the criteria that they're trying to use in terms of their argument.
But that, self-awareness for 8 hours a day doesn't work for me. I mean, I'm not self-aware 8 hours a day. When I'm unconscious in bed, I'm not technically self. I could be self-aware if someone wakes me up, but someone could walk in and say, well, Wilkin is unresponsive. He's not self-aware.
And that's what they did in the Terri Schiavo case. I mean, this is the same philosophy that's apparently all throughout our culture and within some branches of Christianity.
Dennis, thank you. Interesting conversation. Ironic, isn't it? Ironic that the Hindu, who's a panentheist, is more willing to assert the protection of life in the petri dish of the womb than the Episcopalian. A good question, Dennis, if you're ever getting a conversation with a professing Christian again on that whole issue and they assert that it's a clump of cells, you might go to the incarnation of our Lord Jesus Christ and ask that question. If this blastocyst of 5 days is nothing more than a clump of cells, actually, Dr. Hurlbut responded to that fairly nicely in the course of a conversation with him. He said, if you study the embryo, even at 5 days, there's no way you're going to call it a clump of cells. It is far too organized, miraculously organized, to be called a clump of cells. Clump denotes a disorganized wad of something, a bunch of something, all clumped together. That's not what the embryo is. Even if you're talking about how organized it is, not to mention that it is how all of us began, including Jesus our Savior in his incarnation. What was Jesus at 5 days? Clump of cells? I mean, any Christian who takes the incarnation seriously or claims to take it seriously. This is really, by the way, a little secret, the reason why Christians are pro-life. We are not pro-life first and foremost out of moral considerations. Those are very important. We are pro-life first and foremost because our Savior chose the path of the Virgin's womb to the cross for us. And who he is in the womb tells us who each of us is at that same stage. We'll be talking in a few minutes with Dr. A.A. Housepin about vegetative states and picking up on Dennis's call, the terrible, deadly logic, as Richard John Newhouse calls it, the lethal logic that led people to say, look, someone's not responding, they're not self-aware. Is that what a vegetative state is? We'll find out here in just a few minutes after Open Lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
In the meantime, Dr. Arnold Kriegstein, head of stem cell research at the University of California at San Francisco, is raising $5 million in private money to build a brand new laboratory that duplicates facilities the university already has. It's necessary because scientists are only permitted to work with new embryonic stem cell lines if their lab does not receive any federal funding.
So if you have things like microscopes, petri dishes, refrigerators to store things, downstairs, you can't use those. You have to buy microscopes, refrigerators, petri dishes to use up here.
Absolutely.
Now, at least, just I'm interrupting to point something out. At least there's a bit of honesty at this point in the report. This is about taxpayer money. The ethical issue is about who is the embryo. That's obvious to anyone who knows anything about embryos, even someone like me. The issue for the researchers, the dollar signs for the researchers, is about taxpayer money. If you want to use federal funds, you can only use a limited number of stem cell lines. That's true. As of August 2001, President Bush signed an executive order saying only these several lines if you want federal money. Well, I would say to the researcher, I think Ed Bradley should have asked the researcher, look, the government isn't the only source of money around here. The state of California isn't the only source of money around here. If this is worthy research, go out and beat the bushes. Find the money. There are people out there with checkbooks. They're ready to fund these life-saving cures as you claim they are. Why don't you get private money? Why do you sit waiting, pining for federal money? There is a reason for that. It's been pointed out by many guests on this program, not the least of which is Wesley Smith. He says the private money isn't flowing into this kind of research. It's not considered a fruitful investment. It hasn't shown that it can deliver on the promises it makes. And private money is like any other investment. It's my water-powered car. If I came to you with my promises and said, now I want your money, I want you to invest in it, you would want to see me driving down the street in my water-powered car before you gave me a penny. Or at least in my water-powered moped. Right? And this is the reason private money isn't going into big biotech for embryonic stem cell research. All sorts of other research has no trouble getting private money. This, not so much. That's not mentioned in this.
Absolutely. All the materials and supplies, all the consumable materials, everything that's involved in any of this work needs to be paid for through private funds.
But this is a big expenditure of funds just to construct what you already have.
That's one of the problems. It's very costly and it's time consuming and it has been slowing down progress in the field.
Here we go.
But there is one area of stem cell research that is now ready for human testing. And it may be the only chance that Joanna and Marcus Kerner have to save the life of their 6-year-old son, Daniel. The FDA recently approved a clinical trial using brain stem cells from fetal tissue to treat the rare and always fatal neurological disorder called Batten disease, which Daniel was diagnosed with a year and a half ago. The Kerner's doctor gave them the grim prognosis.
He shook his head, said, "I'm sorry. There's no cure."
He has Batten disease.
And suddenly you're told your child is going to die, this horrible, horrific, long, prolonged death of blindness, loss of all motor skills, dementia, and like a flower, wilting.
If Daniel is among the six children selected for this clinical trial, he will receive an injection of neural stem cells from aborted fetuses that are several weeks more developed than embryos. Based on studies in mice, it's expected the transplanted cells will produce a crucial brain enzyme and slow the progression of the disease.
Are you at all hesitant about this? I mean, one, you don't know if it'll work. Two, you don't know if it's safe. It's never been done before.
He's going to die anyway, Ed. And I'd rather he go down fighting. Because he's a fighter. He's brave. And he wants to live.
Scientists will be closely monitoring the results of the clinical trial for Batten disease, looking for clues that could help in the development of stem cell treatments for a variety of neurological disorders. They will also be awaiting the outcome in California of a court case, a trial set to begin tomorrow, to determine whether to free up the $3 billion for embryonic stem cell research that was allocated by Proposition 71.
That was Sunday night, 60 Minutes, Ed Bradley talking about embryonic stem cell research. Now, I don't want to be too cynical about it, but they do end the piece with the most tear-jerking story they can possibly come up with. A six-year-old boy who is terminal and who's, at least according to the story, whose last hope is stem cells from aborted fetuses. And the doctor says, Ed asks the father, you know, this is dangerous. This is potentially very dangerous for your son. Well, he's going to die anyway. And I want him to go down fighting. What father wouldn't want that? I mean, I would want that. I would want every possible proper avenue explored to the very end. But this isn't about whether people want cures or not. This isn't about whether or not we want to fight disease or find cures or not. This is about how we're going to go about doing that. Are we willing to cross those ethical lines, the lines of destroying human life to save human life? Are we willing to cross that threshold? For the remainder of this hour and into the next, we're going to shift gears a bit and talk about vegetative states. What do you think about when you hear that now very common household term, persistent vegetative state, or you hear that someone is now a vegetable? Dr. A.A. Hausepian is an assistant adjunct professor of psychiatry in the University of California, San Francisco, Fresno Medical Education Program. He's author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled "Very Quiet People, Ethical, Medical, and Theological Perspective on Those in Vegetative and Other Hypokinetic States." Dr. Hausepian, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Before we get to what a persistent vegetative state really is, what do you think most people think when they hear vegetative state?
As the name seems to suggest, I think most people think of individuals in this state as being akin to vegetables, individuals who have lost their personalities, lost their personhood. In some quarters, these individuals are looked at as being corpses that are ready for burial. The general public, I think, however, looks at these individuals as being live, vegetative humans, individuals who have lost the capacity of anything human.
What did the researchers, Jennett and Plum, back in 72, that you mentioned in your piece, what did they mean when they first coined the term persistent vegetative state?
Jennett and Plum were very careful in how they understood this condition. They very specifically stated that those in a vegetative state appear to be unconscious, did not have detectable consciousness or detectable awareness. They didn't say that these individuals, in fact, have no awareness or no consciousness, but simply emphasized our inability to detect that awareness or consciousness.
Why were they cautious to distinguish between our ability to detect and some sort of absolute state where they could say consciousness is absent?
You know, I think, first of all, they're, I think, terrific clinicians and terrific researchers who are aware of the complexities involved in making judgments about the absence of things, including the absence of consciousness. There are so many variables that impair an individual's ability to express the consciousness that they, in fact, might be experiencing. And so, given all these variables, it's prudent to simply say, look, we can't detect awareness here. We can't detect consciousness here. It might be here. Our tools are still very blunt. They are not yet so sophisticated that we can tell in each case what someone might be experiencing. These individuals might not be able to help us very much in virtue of certain disabilities that they have. They won't be able to communicate whatever experiences they may be having. So Jeanette and Plum simply said, these are individuals that we are unable to judge as having consciousness, not that they are, in fact, unconscious. And it's been very interesting, since after their seminal paper in 1972, the medical community oftentimes shifted into a mode in which they made judgments about certain individuals who appear to be unconscious, and said that those individuals, in fact, are wholly unconscious. And other individuals that might appear to be unconscious, they said, because of certain things that we might be able to do to coax them to communicate, that those individuals were robustly conscious, that they are in what are called locked-in states, that they have as much consciousness as you or I have, but simply can't express it. So we had this kind of dichotomy. You're either wholly unconscious or you're robustly conscious, and there's really was nothing much in between. Jeanette and Plum left a lot of territory in between to investigate that hasn't been investigated up until fairly recently.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. A.A. Hovsepian, Assistant Adjunct Professor of Psychiatry in the University of California, San Francisco, Fresno Medical Education Program. We're talking about vegetative states. He's written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Very Quiet People, Ethical, Medical, and Theological Perspective on Those in Vegetative or Other Hypokinetic States. There's a better term that our guest suggests, and it's in the title of his article, Hypokinetic, Very Quiet People. More descriptive. When we come back, we're going to talk about that spectrum between the robustly conscious and those who are genuinely and perhaps irreversibly, although that's not always the case either, unconscious. Now, once you determine where someone falls along that spectrum, you still have not answered the theological, the ethical questions. Terry Schindler Schiavo was deprived of both water and food to her death. And whether or not she was conscious or unconscious, in the end was irrelevant. That was still the wrong way for her to die. We'll talk more about that after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.